history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories waiting to be told right there in your community. Usually, all it takes is a willingness to ask a few questions and, of course, the patience to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we do that, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I trust that you've enjoyed this holiday season with your family, and if you haven't yet, make sure you pause to remember, and if you're so inclined, to pray for those men and women in uniform right now, all over the globe, putting their lives on the line for our country and our ideals. If you caught our last episode, you were introduced to Pearl Harbor survivor Mickey Ganich of San Leandro, California. At age 100, he's actually busier than I am, if you can believe that. If you missed the first part of our conversation, you can access the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also find a video of the moment a couple years ago when Mickey caused quite a bit of a stir at the White House.
Throughout the war, one great battle cry could be heard by American friends and foes alike. Remember Pearl Harbor. Have you heard that before a couple of times? Remember Pearl Harbor.
Remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Just remember Pearl Harbor as we dig the Alamo. We shall always remember how they died for liberty. Just remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
Yeah. What can I say? Wow, that was good. He's a very shy person, too. And a great football player.
Boy, it's something to hear that rat-a-tat-tat of all those camera shutters. And Mickey was quite a football player, as the president said. In fact, he was supposed to be playing a football game on December 7th, 1941. In today's episode, we're going to hear about some of his experiences after Pearl Harbor on the battleship USS Pennsylvania, including a torpedo attack just days before the Japanese surrender that claimed the lives of 20 of his shipmates. Also, what he had to do during atomic bomb tests after World War II. What he enjoyed about returning to Hawaii for the 78th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor earlier this month. And of course, what's his secret to being so youthful, active, and prolific at the age of 100? But to set the stage for all of that, let's hear some excerpts of his memories of December 7th, 1941.
We were ready to play a game. We had a game out on the ship's football team and made the first team on. I wasn't very big. That's pretty big. That's 170 pounds there. That was big in those days. Now if you're not 250, you're nothing there. So I joined the ship's football team, and we had a great team. And we scheduled to play USS Arizona for a fleet football championship, 1 o'clock, December 7, 1941. That was going to be the Super Bowl of the Navy. It was really important there. So we was going to do a little scrimmage and get ready for the game and leave the ship at 8 o'clock in the morning, December 7. There was no place to change clothes. A little field was close by to us there. So we had all our padding on for the attack. When the attack came there, you go to your battle station, you don't have time to change clothes or anything. So up in the crow's nest, I went in my football uniform, all my padding on there, little trap door to get up there, pull myself through to get up there. That was my battle station. I was a lookout. Whether you're in port or not there, mm-hmm. You go where your battle station is. We're going to leave the ship at 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. It takes about 4 or 5 minutes get from the living compartment, the quartermaster's, to get up on deck so we leave the ship at 8 o'clock. About 6 minutes to 8, the phone rang. I picked up the phone. One of the fellows on the deck was up on deck of our gang. Called on and said, Japanese attack in Pearl Harbor. I said, oh, come on, let's not talk about it. Because we'd been talking about it for months there, but we feared there was no chance for us. About that time, the ship shuddered. Some of our fellows that were close to the guns went to the guns and started shooting at the planes before we knew below decks knew what was going on. About that time, General Quarters went, "All hands man your battle stations. Now, get from there up to the poles there, which you, I guess you'd call it there, the mast there with the closeness. That's where I had to go." So by the time I got up there, ships were burning, planes were burning, planes were flying around there. Look close enough, you hit them with rocks. If you had anything to throw at them, I could have thrown my binoculars at them because I was a lookout. That was all I had up there. But by the time I got up there, just a few minutes time, because you're going and you're going double time or triple time, get up there in a hurry because you don't know what was going on. It was pretty hectic.
Yeah.
But I was well protected with all my padding on.
All your football pads.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A little trap door to get through there. Pull myself through with all the padding on. I couldn't go straight through. It wasn't that wide. So I pulled myself through with my trap door and get up there. And it was kind of bad looking, seeing planes coming all around you. And it got pretty rough. But the Japanese didn't know where we were the first attack that they had, because we weren't in our normal place. But evidently, some of the Japanese pilots reported to the aircraft carrier that there's a big ship in dry dock with two other destroyers. So the second attack, they hit us. Bomb missed me by 45 feet. Armor-piercing bomb, 500-pound bomb, came on past me. I'm on the closeness. It came way down, exploded way below me. If it exploded on contact, I wouldn't be here talking to you. It's kind of scary to see a big hole alongside of you there.
So but, if it had been a conventional bomb as opposed to armor-piercing, it would have gone off on the deck and you would have been gonzo.
Yeah.
And as it stands, you're up on this crow's nest. So when that bomb detonates below deck, I'm sure that was quite an earthquake for you.
It really shook me, but we didn't know where it hit because if I saw the bomb coming, I probably died right there.
Again, if you want to hear a more extensive discussion of December 7th and Mickey Ganich's experiences there, pull up our last episode, number 607, at hometownheroesradio.com for that. We split up our talk with Mickey into two parts because this spirited centenarian had quite a bit more to say. Your ship is kind of a microcosm or an epitome of the Navy as a whole, because here the Navy's been dealt this devastating blow on December 7th, and your ship was damaged and was going to need to get retooled for the war. So you limp back here to San Francisco, and as you said, they send you up to Attu and Kiska. What was the morale or the camaraderie aboard that ship after everything you guys had been through?
It was great. People, when we can do something to fight back. And it wasn't really till the Aleutian Islands where we really were fighting back itself. We had a little bit of something there. The morale of the United States there was so bad there that happened in April of 1942. They found a man by the name of Jimmy Doolittle. He was an aircraft colonel. And he devised a plan there to bomb Japan there bombers would take off of an aircraft carrier, bomb Japan, continue on to China where fuels were prepared for them. They did do it, and think about how big an aircraft carrier is, 800 to 900 feet long, and then the aircraft have to take off from it. They weren't going to land on it, but they were able to take off, but they did take off and did bomb Japan. It didn't do much damage, but they did two things. They helped the morale of the United States. We're finally doing something back. It wasn't really until that time that we did something fighting back itself. All we were doing was taking a beating out there.
Mm-hmm.
And also, besides bombing Japan, didn't do much damage. Japan figured they better do something, so they pulled some of their planes, some of their tanks, some of their men troops back to their mainland. And that meant less that we had to fight with when we took over the island. So it did those two things, help the morale of the United States. But everybody was jubilant when they heard that that happened there. We're doing something, we'll get them.
Mm-hmm.
So it helped the morale of the United States. We up to that point. things were really bad. And then 2 months later, June of 1942, is when they had the Battle of Midway, the turning point of the war, where four of the six aircraft carriers that Japan used for the attack on Pearl Harbor, they only had four of them there at the Battle of Midway. All four of them were sunk. And as a result, their good pilots were gone. And that's when they got back, they're reverting back to kamikaze planes, kamikaze pilots. Planes and pilots were trained to take off but not worry too much about landing because they're not going to land. Most of them will die for the emperor. So but the Battle of Midway, and just shortly after the attack by Jimmy Doolittle's group on Japan, those two things, that was a turning point from war. From then on, we were working our way, plus the fact there that the women were furnishing us with what we needed there, we was able to replace the ships and tanks and guns and planes and everything that were lost there, we were able to replace it. Japan was unable to do that.
Have you seen that, the new Midway movie that came out?
No, but I understand it's supposed to be good, and I plan on seeing it.
So you guys were up in the Aleutians while that was going on.
Yes.
And then you mentioned some of the other invasions you supported. What were your duties on the ship during all that time?
I'd start out as a lookout, but then I started getting training there for steering the ship. So I become quite an experienced steersman. In fact, they used me most of the time going in and out of port. I was a steersman, because I was the best one that they had. And I thought that was pretty good for a farm boy.
I don't think they ever taught you how to dodge torpedoes on the farm.
No. One experience that really had their invasion of the Philippines, the first invasion of the Philippines, a lady golfer at the Philippines there, who had troops on land, fighting what's going on there. Ships were in the harbor, some of them unloading troops, some of them loading supplies and different things. And I'm steering this 33,000-ton battleship, because we're at battle stations there. Steering the ship all around there, a kamikaze plane got in there. This is daytime. It hit one of the destroyers, Abner Reed. And we're all at battle stations, your torpedoes are armed. It set off her torpedoes coming out throughout the fleet. We got the word there, reporting a torpedo coming from that destroyer. Captain says, hard right rudder, steer for it, give it a small target as you can. Now, a car goes, when it turns, it goes right around the corner. Ship kind of goes this way like it. I look, see the weight coming from that torpedo coming at it. I got to hold a bar over here, and I got the rudder over hard as I can. Hold on, here it comes. It went right underneath us. Evidently there when the torpedo was launched off of that destroyer, the ship was tall enough, it went a little bit deeper. That's kind of scary. There's no place to run. Like you're driving the car down the street and you see a car come right at you. The way you can do it's kind of scary.
Yeah. So you're there bracing for impact.
Yes.
And you feel nothing.
Nothing.
And you're saying that's because this American destroyer was listing in the water, and that changed the angle.
That's the only thing I can explain.
That's a close enough call for me. And did I hear correctly that you actually saw through your binoculars that famous scene with MacArthur wading ashore?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's how I'm wading ashore. That's the second time he tried first, and then he got other clothes. He had one look a little bit better, so he changed clothes, and then they took the pictures of him. And instead of his clothes all messed up, he had to look sharp after wading ashore. But then after after that invasion there, then our guns wouldn't shoot straight. They sent us back to the States. We came back to Bethlehem Steel in San Francisco, get new guns. We missed Iwo Jima and Okinawa. That's the only invasions in the North Pacific my ship missed.
So and when you say our guns wouldn't shoot straight, because they'd been overused in the Philippines?
Yeah.
So they melted some of the barrels?
Yeah, some of the guns, we figured out they could do without us there while we came back to the States to get new guns. In fact, some of the guns we got were taken off of the USS Oklahoma. The one that rolled over inside, they took the guns off of it before they sold it for scrap air. And so we got some of her guns there and used for ours. Hers wasn't shot there very many times there. So Iwo Jima and Okinawa was back in our hands. Next step was invasion of Japan. So this is July of 1945. We're on our way back to Okinawa. Get ready with the fleet and get ready for the invasion of Japan.
And we're going to stop things right there for now. When we come back, what happened to Mickey Gannich and the USS Pennsylvania just days before the Japanese surrendered? And also, what keeps him going at age 100? Find photos and video at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and part two of our interview with 100-year-old Mickey Gannich of San Leandro, California, the 12th of 14 children and the last one living. He grew up on a farm in Ohio, survived the attack on Pearl Harbor aboard the USS Pennsylvania, which was in dry dock that day, and he stayed on that battleship through the rest of World War II and beyond. The need for repairs forced the Pennsylvania to miss the invasions of Iwo Jima and Okinawa, but in July 1945, Mickey and his shipmates were headed toward Okinawa to prepare for the planned invasion of mainland Japan.
Something happened August 6th of 1945. They dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. 3 days later, August 9th, they dropped an atomic bomb on Nagasaki. 3 days later, August 12th, we got in Okinawa. All the other ships are in there. We anchored in there. 8:30 that night, Japanese plane came on with its lights on. Nobody fired a shot at it. They thought it's a friendly plane. Aimed its torpedo at the coast of the big ship it saw, battleship Pennsylvania. The living compartment, the quartermaster's, is back by the rudder, back by the propellers. That's where the living compartment was. Half hour before that, I went up the bridge. I was going to write a letter to one of my sisters. 8:30 at night, when that Japanese plane came in, launched that torpedo, it hit the propellers back there. Everything went in and up. The living compartment, the quartermasters, I had 26 quartermasters. I lost 20 of them that night. The next morning, Japanese asked for peace. We're trying to stay afloat. Well, it's on the peace treaty in Tokyo Bay. They told us in the shallow ground, so if we sink, we just sink in the mud. We'll say, we'll stay afloat. We got hit at Pearl Harbor, never got hit again till the night before Japanese asked for peace.
And if I'm understanding you correctly, had you not gone above to write the letter to your sister, you would have been in there where the torpedo hit.
Yeah. I forgot I had other plans for me there, too.
And in this case, those 20 men who were killed were guys had come to know very well.
I knew them. I knew them by their first names there. And being on the ship there and knowing them by their first names, they worked for me and I knew them. And one of my jobs is to identify bodies and parts of bodies here. I hope I never have to go through something like that again, identifying by the clothing, the stencils on their clothing and names there, trying to identify them and collect their gear and send it home to their families. In fact, one of my first class, the one that was next one under me, I took his clothes back to his folks back in Wisconsin there. Mm. That was hard to do.
I can't imagine anything more difficult. I mean, what do you say in a situation like that?
And when the ship got torpedoed there at Okinawa, it sunk so far down in the back part of the ship where you could step right on the water. Four bodies were recovered that morning, first thing. Divers went down and pulled guys over close and grabbed a hold of one guy's arm, and I pulled his arm back out of his socket. That's awfully hard to do.
And when it's so close to the end of the war,
yeah.
How should those guys be remembered all these years later?
By treating each other like they treated you. They were alive, we had treated each other respectfully, lovingly, try to be friends with everybody. I think with them, that would be a plus if the people would know it.
You know, and I've talked to so many veterans for whom VJ Day was a day of celebration, and they were excited. Here, the war is finally over. But it sounds like for your ship, that must have been bittersweet considering what had just happened.
Yeah. They told us to Guam, which is the war's over. They already signed it. We're still sitting there. And they told us to Guam there. And during the period from Okinawa to Guam, because there's a floating dry dock down there, they told us that three tugs pulled us there because we didn't have any power at that time. So the war was, the peace treaty was being signed. We got in Guam, put us in a floating dry dock, and recovered many we can of the bodies and all. And we got patched up, and they sent us back to the States. The war is over. They sent back to the States. We got about 300-400 miles east of Guam. Well, we had to, when the torpedo hit, it wiped out the propellers on the right side. One on the left side was good, and one was not so good. About 300-400 miles east of Guam there, we started having problems with the propeller. So we stopped the ship. We were all by ourselves. The war is over there, and everybody else went in their different directions there. We stopped the ship, put divers over the side, see what they could do. Because in all big ships, you have divers. We put divers over the side, see what they can do with that propeller. Meantime, sharks were attracted by parts of bodies that are still on the ship there. We pulled the divers out of the water, put boats in the water with the Marines there with rifles to keep the sharks away from the divers so they could work on the propeller. So we came back to the States by ourselves with one propeller out of four.
And if they hadn't been able to repair that one, what would have happened to you guys? You were dead in the water, huh?
We'd be out there like the Indianapolis, the one that took the atomic bomb there to Tinian for bombing over Japan there. We'd been in bad shape, but fortunes of the war, I guess, well, that's what you'd call it.
What was it like to make it back to the States after the war was over?
Quite a relief, because we didn't have to worry about being attacked there and finally got things settled because the war in Europe was all settled there a few months before that. And this was September 2nd, they signed a peace treaty on the Missouri in Tokyo Bay. So it's quite a relief now we can get back to normal if we can and think about what happened there and think about the future, what's going to happen.
Did you think about getting out of the Navy?
No, because I decided to make it a career of the Navy before I even joined. One of the guys that I talked to that I respected said, if you're going to go just for a short time, you're wasting your time. So I made it a career. I studied. In fact, I passed up two people in my gang because they spent their time in the bars there. I spent my time there studying there. I passed them up. I joined the Navy January 21st of 1941. I made Chief Petty Officer March 1st of 1945. So I was the Chief Quartermaster there when we were attacked at the Okinawa. Yeah, but I had made it a career, and I figured if I'm going to be in them, I'd see what I could do and better myself. And as a result, evidently I was able to do it, making chief petty officer in that short of time. We had other people that spent 10 years in there and never even made chief petty officer. I made the best use of my time.
Well, and you're one of the last guys left who served on the Pennsylvania in World War II. And you also got to witness the end of the Pennsylvania, huh? You guys were part of the atomic bomb testing?
We were atomic bomb testing. See, my ship was damaged there in 1946. They wanted to see what they could do, what atomic bomb damage would do on various things. We're already damaged there, and by 1946, we just have a skeleton crew, because the war is over there, and so the ship is already partially damaged there, and the users for the atomic bomb test at Bikini Atoll in September 1946 there. So the atomic bomb was new. They already saw what damage there that atomic bomb would have on land with the Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now they wanted to find out what damage it'd have on ships. So they got a variety of ships. They had English ships, they had Japanese ships, they had Dutch ships there, and our ships of various different sizes, because they wanted to find out what damage atomic bomb would have on various metals and stuff. So this is a way to find out what it was. So it took us to Bikini Atoll, which is an atoll west of the Hawaiian Islands there, and put us in the harbor itself, or not a harbor, it's an atoll itself. That's what they call it out in the Pacific here. Put us in there, took us off in another ship there. They're going to have two blasts. One's at the air blast and one's an underwater blast. Air blast there, took us off another ship about 10 miles away, and they said, make sure you turn your back to where the atomic bomb is going to explode. Close your eyes, put your eyes over your arm. I still saw the flash. It was that strong.
You had your arm over your eyes, but yeah, you could still see the flash.
I still saw the flash there. Now they want to find out what damage it have on animals. So I'm a farm boy, so they put me in charge of goats, mice, pigs, and sheep. Put them throughout the ships there. Put them. The Coast Geodetic Survey furnished all the animals. So I put the animals in the various places throughout the ship there. They spread the ships out, put the atomic bomb right in the middle, underwater blast. This we could watch. It took us off in another ship there. This we could watch. You heard of the tsunami there, the wall of water come up. That's what it was like. In fact, I saw the USS Saratoga, the aircraft carrier, practically standing up like that, because in there, it was pretty close to the center of where it was.
There's a great photo of that. You can see the Saratoga from keel to stern pointing upwards inside this giant water spout created by the bomb.
Yeah.
And you were watching that live.
I watched it. Now they wanted to know where I put all the animals. I had to go back on the ship to show them where I put all the animals. After I showed them where it was, it said, throw away your clothes and take a good shower. Your clothes are radioactive. It must not affect me too much, because I got 13 grandchildren, 18 great-grandchildren, 9 great-great-grandchildren. I'm atomic man. I just don't have $6 million. It's supposed to go, it's supposed to go with it there. So
what did you ever see or hear of any of the results of what happened to the animals, or what they learned?
I found out there that some of the white mice had little ones. Evidently, the atomic bomb must have inspired them to produce there, because that's what I found out later.
Uh-huh.
And also, they towed the Pennsylvania to Kwajalein, which is back towards the Hawaiian Islands itself.
Mm-hmm.
It tried to wash it off in 1948, almost 2 years later. It was still radioactive. They pulled it outside the harbor, pulled the plugs. It would not sink. They end up torpedoing it. It's the bottom of the ocean off of Kwajalein right now. It's still radioactive. It wasn't too radioactive for me to go on it and show them where to put all the animals there. But
have you ever had any concern that you would have effects of that radioactivity?
They tested there and found evidently must have not hurt me too much. I'm still here.
Yeah, I don't know too many 100-year-olds who are doing the 9-to-5 like you are. And then you stayed in through the Korean War. What were you doing during the Korean War?
On the ammunition ship. Uh-huh. I got on the ammunition ship in 1948. I got off of 1954. I was on it for 68 months. And during that period of time was when the Korean War was on. And we were taking ammunition from the port out to the ships out at sea so they could, wouldn't need to come back to the port to get their ammunition. We'd take it to them.
What's safer than an ammunition ship, right?
you're sleeping on a powder keg. When people, when they had a smoker, they'd take them in a boat to take it. We'd get in port, they'd have to go in a boat and smoke out there because there was no smoking on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
It's too dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you put in 22 years in the Navy.
Well, over 22 and a half, so I got credit for, that's why I say 23, because I get credit for 23.
My apologies, 23 years. When you look back on it now, what are the things that give you the most pride or satisfaction?
Pride that I was able to learn something new, because steering a ship is not like working on a farm.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned the discipline. Discipline helps people. I think the problems that we have nowadays, the kids are not accountable for their own action. If they do something wrong, the father and mother or the relatives bail them out of what they're doing, so they don't learn. They don't learn by experience, and they're not accountable for their own action. If they do something wrong, you'll blame it on somebody else there, so they don't learn by experience. If they would learn by experience, if they make a mistake next time, no better, the country and the world would be better off. That's mm-hmm. why I teach them in schools there. Be accountable for their own action. Don't be afraid to make a mistake. This country is founded on mistakes, and people do something that didn't work, or they improve it, and improve better there, and they learn. But the main thing is for the kids to be accountable for their own actions. That's what I think the biggest problem we have through the world there. And then we got all this party system. This party suggests that the other party's against it. This party's for it, the other one's against it. If we get tired of that, my wife is a registered Republican, I'm a registered Democrat there. Last 15 years, I would say, and more, we've been married 56 years there.
Mm-hmm.
We don't care what party they belong to. We vote for the person who we care for better or for worse, is the best country is. If they don't like this country, I'll help them move to another one. That's why I end up my talks here.
Uh-huh.
For better or for worse.
Well, we're not done talking with him here on Hometown Heroes either, for better or for worse. It's pretty amazing how sharp he is and how busy his calendar is at age 100. The one and only Mickey Ganich. Catch the rest of his story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
Sammy K. Orchestra and Remember Pearl Harbor. In a bit, we'll talk to 100-year-old Mickey Ganich about the time 2 years ago when he sang part of that a cappella in the White House on national TV. Just one of countless appearances Mickey has made over the years in an effort to keep the legacy of Pearl Harbor alive and to honor his fellow veterans. Well, and I know you've given so many talks, more than you can count. How long have you been doing that, and how long are you going to keep doing it?
I'm too long to be able to get around at all. When I can't drive by myself, I'll get maybe get the wife or someone to drive me there. I'll get there. I get a kick out of some of these times, and I set up an appointment there for a speaking engagement. I said, what time can we pick you up? And I said, for what? So you can get there. I said, I got my own car. You drive your own car? Sure, I'll drive my own car. In fact, I just renewed my driver's license for 5 years. But I would estimate I've been doing it the last 12, 15 years. I don't even know. I mean, in fact, I got all kinds of certificates and plaques and stuff at home. And there's some challenge coins. Some of these places where I have speaking engagement, they have a challenge coins that they give me there. But I don't even know how long I've been giving talks.
Well, and I'm just looking around your office here, and I see a picture of you in the state capitol of California. There's a picture of Pearl Harbor and the Arizona Memorial. I've seen you on TV at the Giants games and the Oakland Raiders games.
And about a year now, let's see, it's December 17th, the White House there.
Yeah.
President Trump was signing a peace, signing the proclamation for December 17th in Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, and I sang Remember Pearl Harbor over national TV right alongside of him. Right?
That's what I wanted to ask you about. So you're there in the White House with the president.
Yeah.
What made you decide to sing?
Well, we had it arranged there. The Greatest Generation Foundation, Denver, Colorado. We were talking about it there because I've sang before different schools and all that there. And he says, after he put me right alongside of the president, and the others are strung out this way. And he says, when he gets through with that there, you sing Remember Pearl Harbor. So when he got through signing that and everything was done there, and I was saying Remember Pearl Harbor there, and he was about to stop me from doing it, so I went through the whole thing over national TV.
Uh-huh.
That made me feel pretty good.
Yeah.
We had a range there that was going to do it.
Well, and that's something for people today, maybe they've never heard it before. But in the months and years after Pearl Harbor, I'm sure you guys would hear that every once in a while, right?
Yeah.
That was a pretty powerful thing.
Yeah.
You don't want to sing it right now, do you?
Why not?
I'm not stopping you.
Remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Just remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We shall always remember how they died for liberty. Just remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
Mm-hmm. Well done. How did the president react when you did that right next to him?
A little surprised. Then I got down to 3-point stand, told him I'm ready for that football game, which we didn't play. He looked at me and he said, I wouldn't play football against you. Yes, he told me. Then he gave me his challenge coin. I didn't bring it with me today. He gave me his challenge coin. Things about that thick there.
Well,
he got his name on it 3 different places.
Well, and I've got to ask you. Because you just shared that your wife's a Republican and you're a Democrat.
Yeah.
And that doesn't keep the two of you apart.
That's right.
And here we all are in a very polarized time in our country where the Democrats and Republicans are in a pretty severe fight involving the president right now. But that didn't seem to keep you from enjoying his company.
That's right. That's right. He said, how can you even associate with those people? They were enemies. I said, to me, it's like a game. You're on the field during the daytime. That evening, you went out to supper together. He said, you shouldn't even associate with them. I said, the wife who drives a Japanese car. So what? The war is over. You can't change what happened. Think about the future. We're good friends now. That's the way we feel. In fact, 2 different times they chased me down the street. I've been to Japan many times there since the war's over. Mm-hmm. 2 different times they chased me down the street there. I left my wallet in the store. I got my money back in my wallet. This country, maybe you'd get your wallet back, you wouldn't get your money. I found out they're honest there. They're friends now. Forget, you can't change what happened before. Think about what we're going to do for the future.
Amen. And hearing you sing Remember Pearl Harbor, just like the Sammy Kay Orchestra, you got it just about right where they were. The question that pops into my mind is, why and what? Why is it so important to remember Pearl Harbor? What is it that we need to know all these years later?
Keep America alert there. This is very, we must be doing something right, because all these different countries trying to get to this country to live, so we must be doing something better than they have at their countries. So think about what we can do together. We need each other. This is not a one-man war or one-person war or something like that. You got to have other countries are friendly. You can't be enemies of everybody. You can't rule the world. It seems like we're the world's keeper at times there, but we're putting a lot of our people in danger, and like Vietnam. We got all kinds of people got their lives messed up there because we're a world's keeper, but we can't teach all the countries to have the same religion, same beliefs, same everything. It'd be a dull world if everybody was alike, dressed alike, everything. It'd be just a bunch of robots. But we got to look out for ourselves, too, and take care of our own veterans. We got a lot of homeless veterans there. They're living on the streets there, and a lot of people going hungry there. And then we got to help others. We can help others, but we still got to take care of our own people, too.
Well, I know you do everything you can along those lines, and I don't want to leave out anything that's important to you, but I also don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for continuing to serve your fellow veterans and so many others. I can't finish without asking you, though, what's your secret? Because here you are, 100 years old, and you're still going at this kind of pace. Yeah. How is that possible?
Keep breathing. Don't die.
You haven't stopped yet,
No. Because the alternative isn't so good.
I just have a feeling that for a lot of these years, you've probably looked forward to your 100th birthday and wondered what that was going to be like. And now you just had that a few weeks ago. Yeah. What was it like?
I don't feel any older.
But you had a pretty big shebang for that?
Oh, yeah. With 400 people there and my own relatives there. Some of the relatives I've never met before because they're descendants of cousins and brothers and sisters there, so we had a chance to meet a lot of people I haven't met in my own relatives, plus all the, because right now, the only thing I'm doing right now, I'm chaplain in the Fleet Reserve, I'm chaplain in American Legion, I'm chaplain in Veteran Fort Wars, I'm chaplain in the Masons, I'm adjutant for this disabled American veterans. I've been the head usher of my church, I think it's 55 years there, something like that, 54, 55 years. And then I'm a volunteer at the VA clinic, taking veterans to their appointments and whatnot, whatever I can do for them. Because I was helped many times while I was in the service. So I learned there that you help each other and they help you. So that's why I dedicated myself to get in these organizations, be a part. I didn't want to be just a card-carrying member. I want to be a part of them. If I'm going to be in it, I want to be a part of them. That's why I get active in there. Commander of this chapter there for quite a few years there, and now it's a treasurer, and then the chaplain there, and everything else there. But I want the help of veterans because they help me, and I want to do my part to help them. I figure that's part of God's plan.
It's hard to argue with that. I guess my last question is, after 100 years, and all the things you just talked about that you've done, that you've contributed, that you've experienced, is there anything you haven't done yet that you're still hoping to do or accomplish?
I can't think of anything right offhand because of course, I'd like to be a little richer than I am. No, but I've accomplished. I think I've been successful in whatever I tried. White says, you ought to travel. I said, I traveled. And I've been to Australia, I've been in China, I've been to Alaska there, and last year I went to Normandy there, and I've been to England, and I've been to Nova Scotia. And I've been practically any place. So really, the only thing that I haven't accomplished there, in 1991, my wife and I planned to go to Yugoslavia, where my folks are from. And about that time, and after just about ready to make arrangements, they started having all kinds of problems over there. So we didn't go. That's about the only thing that I wanted to do that I never accomplished.
Well, there's still time. Maybe that's next for you?
Maybe it could be. But I don't have any relatives over there. At least not that I know of.
Well, I know you have friends everywhere.
Yeah.
And I guess the last thing I should address with you is, because you do this so often, because you talk about this, because you tell the story, and you know that, 2,400 died on December 7th and 406,000 died in World War II, how should those people be remembered? What is their significance all these years later?
Well, I figure by helping other veterans.
That's your tribute to them?
Yes. That's why I got involved in all this, because I figured that would be meaningful to them to know that, I'm helping ones that are still with us.
I know there's three guys left still from the Arizona. You think you could get that football game after all?
Yeah, maybe we'll play that game. Got to be ready for that game. We didn't cancel the game. We just postponed it. We had a war to fight.
Is there anything else I didn't ask you about that you wanted to say?
No, I told you some of my scary moments.
Yeah. And you never got yourself in any trouble, huh?
No. Oh, I've been in trouble, but nothing serious.
Uh-huh.
I just didn't get caught.
Fair enough.
People say, oh, thank you for your service. We never figured out the comeback. What it's about. What to say. Sometimes I'd say thank you, but that is not. That doesn't matter. They're thanking me, and I'm thanking them, and that doesn't work out. So we got, whenever they say thank you for service, it's going to say you were worth it.
Mm.
You were worth it.
I just realized I forgot to ask you about December 7th, 2019. You were back there at Pearl Harbor 78 years after that Japanese bomb came whizzing past your perch in the crow's nest of the USS Pennsylvania. I love that photo of you in a three-point stance next to our friend Donnie Edwards, the former All-Pro linebacker who's blessed so many World War II veterans through his Best Defense Foundation. But I want to know what that experience was like for you. I know there weren't too many of you Pearl Harbor survivors there. What was it like this time?
Well, went to a lot of places and talked to a lot of people, and I had a chance to talk to several school classes while I was there also. And so that made me feel good that I was able to do that there, because the kids, especially the kids there, that they're listening. That's my reward. They're listening to what you said. They're not sleeping or looking out the window or something. They're paying attention. That's my reward. That's what I get back for them. If I could convert one person to be accountable for the action, I fear I'm doing something there, because I think that's the biggest problem we have with the kids nowadays. That's why I like to talk to schools. I've talked to schools, kindergarten there, grade school, middle school, high schools, and colleges there. I've talked to all of them. Mm-hmm. I don't care. I've talked to as many as 10 people, and I've talked to as much as 900 people one time. Try to say that I have no animosity there. You can't change what happened. All we can think about are the future and the friends that we have for the future.
Well, I'm sure thankful to be able to call you a friend now, and I'm looking forward to the future because I know you're not slowing down. Mickey Ganich, 100 years old. What an inspiration. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today and all throughout 2019. We're already working on bringing you the stories of many more remarkable veterans in 2020. So happy new year. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.